Oh, Sal is a sweetheart. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes, he is. And interestingly enough, he is the last Arab hero in contemporary Western film, really.
Really? Wow, that shocks me.
The following podcast features topics discussed by geeks or under the supervision of nerds. Accordingly, Geek Life and its producers must insist that no one attempt to recreate or reenact any of the topics or bad impressions performed on this show.
Welcome to Geek Life HQ! I'm Justin with an E.
I'm Matt.
Justin with an I. Ditched us. And we're here to talk about an episode that he did. And he doesn't want to show up. He doesn't want to show up because he's too good, because he had an interview with John Rhys Davies from Indiana Jones.
And Sliders. We haven't listened to the interview yet, so we're going to listen to it with you guys. And
yeah, because Justin's too good now that he did this. He's walking around.
He's on a different fucking level.
Yeah, now that he did this interview, he's got a silk robe and a pipe, and he's like, I'm too good for you guys.
Yeah.
So let's take a listen.
Let's listen to it.
That's a little lake called Lake Fungape. Well, since I'm holding this damn thing and I no longer have the setup, I'm going to lie on the bed. Oh, wait a minute. I can't, because they're next door and they're talking and I ought to get out of their hair. Anyway, dear boy, that's the view we wake up to first thing in the morning.
Oh, I'm envious.
Yep. I don't think there are going to be that many views left in 20 years' time. But anyway, I wonder if I do it that way, is it any better? I suppose I could try and, yes, give you a little bit of thing. Are you seeing anything worthwhile? Nothing really.
No, I can see you, and I see the coastline behind you.
Well, it isn't actually a coastline. It's just a lake.
Oh.
We are inland. Right. So, all right, and the camera's there, so I'm looking at you. Very good. My dear boy, I apologize for my technological imbecility is the word I think I'm looking for. I'm just not very good technologically, and I can't get these things to talk to one another. It's really difficult. But anyway, yeah, we're not talking about my technological deficiencies. I see, what a splendid home you have there.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
You still got the Christmas tree up.
Yes, we leave it up until probably my birthday. So it'll probably be up until February 2nd.
Why not? I had a girlfriend once who believed that one shouldn't have a birthday. It should be a birth month.
Oh, that sounds like my girlfriend.
With presents arriving every sort of day, you know. On a graduating scale, perhaps. You know. Fortunately, she didn't press the point too much. Well,
I could imagine just every once a month, perhaps. You know, what's new this month?
Yeah, it's quite. It looks beautiful. Anyway, where are you? Anyway, where are you calling from?
Naperville, Illinois, just outside of Chicago.
I spent a lovely couple of years in Chicago doing a little television series called The Untouchables.
I recall. Yeah.
I played the Sean Connery part.
Is that Michael Malone, was it?
Yes, that's right, yes. I loved Chicago. Chicago, I think, is the perfect combination of a great American city and a great American small town at the same time. Everyone knows everybody in Chicago.
Yeah, it sure seems that way, yeah.
Yeah. And I was meant to be doing some work in Marshall, Michigan, which isn't too far away either. But that one seems to have gone, I think, probably face upwards a little bit.
Hmm.
But I don't really think the money was ever there, and now we're paying for it. But anyway, Grizzly 2.
Yes, yes. I just watched this too, so I gotta say,
we haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
No.
So you probably just remember your parts then from the film.
I do. I do, and don't forget, this is 38 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. This is it's interesting because of the cast of actors and actresses that are in it. It's a star-studded affair for a film that. You know, I call it a good popcorn date movie where you would take your date and, you know, just sit and eat some popcorn and you walk out and you're like, oh, wow, okay, we saw a fun little movie and all that. There's a big lack of those right now. There's not much that's coming out, I feel, that's worthy of that.
Well, I think you're right. It's one of those sort of little mystery movies that real film buffs have talked about over the years, and you know it's probably accrued more mystery to it than it would have actually done had it been released in 1984 and completed. I gather it's only about 80 odd 85 minutes or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a shorter one. It seems like there's some takes that kind of cut into each other. So wasn't sure if there was something that was lost with it, but there's some really good character work. And it's one of those things where my main requirement on seeing a film like this is, do I care about the characters? And I could say, like, when it comes to characters like Bouchard, he was so compelling. It's like, I want to know more about him. Like what does he have for breakfast? You know, What is he doing? Like, how does he clean his axe? You know, like those sorts of things. Just really a compelling sort of performance.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because, you know, it's very hard for actors to judge their performances while they're doing it. And I was in my early 30s. I'd just begun to make a little bit of a dent in terms of recognition. I'd done Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, and I'd done Shogun, and I got an Emmy nomination for Shogun. And of course, I'd worked with Blake Edwards on Victor Victoria,
mm-hmm.
and I'd done I, Claudius, and a few other things like that. And I was really rather pleased with my performance as Bouchard. You know, as I say, I haven't seen it, and I will probably go, oh, God, how could I have thought that this was any good when I do see it? But, you sort of fall in love with some characters. Like, you fall in love with Gimli in Lord of the Rings. You fall in love with Sala in his own way.
Sala's a sweetheart. Absolutely.
Yes. Yes, he is. And interestingly enough, he is the last Arab hero in contemporary Western film, really.
Really? Wow, that shocks me.
Huh. Yes. Somehow things went wrong between the West and the Arab world.
And I was thinking how important his role was, you know, to be down there in the Well of Souls and to be the one that actually helps Indy carry the Ark of the Covenant out. There is no Ark of the Covenant anything. There's no moving the plot forward anything without Sala. He's so integral.
Yes, yes, indeed. He's a wonderful character. Yes, and it was such a great romp, that film. But then, you know, Grizzly was a romp too. It was very strange. It was in a way tragic the way it went. But there are so many wonderful stories attached to it. I mean, you know, the producer ending up in prison for embezzlement and all those other things that, I mean, it really defies belief. The failure of the mechanical, the Ur bear, the devil bear.
That's pretty evident in the film.
Well, yeah, but there are two versions of it. One was, you know, from the top down, it was they can't deliver what they promised in terms of a mechanical bear. From the bottom up, it was we haven't got the money yet to do it. You know, we're already out of pocket, you know, and they're saying that we can pick it up in, you know, after in post-production, and then we can get bits of it working properly. And then if necessarily we can get a, you know, a little bit of reshoot done, you know, with hauling in the actor and the sort of the actors. But in truth, when the producer doesn't turn up for more than one day and just leaves his lovely director just struggling. André Zotz was a lovely man. He'd done a lot of French commercials. He was an accomplished director and understood what the camera can do and how to use it. And he was just left there without any... it's hard for me to indicate what some of its problems were with the actors. One of the actors had two problems. One was the size of his head, and the other was, you know, the amount of white powder that he required to keep him going. As a result, he was somewhat temperamental. I won't, of course, mention who it was.
Interesting.
You know, and that's something a producer has to deal with. The director can't, you know, a director who's hired can't deal with that, you know. And the unwilling, you know, the... A wild ego that doesn't particularly want to bother to learn the lines, but has got the spirit of them and expects, you know, other actors who've come to give their performance and is trying to bully them into playing the scene the way he wants to play it. Well, when you're dealing with a lady called like Louise Fletcher, who really does know?
Oh yeah, yeah.
You cannot expect her to roll over and say, "Oh, of course, you know, you're clearly the, you know, the next Laurence Olivier. I will do whatever you want."
Yeah,
you know, she'll put you in, and you know, and retiring to your hotel, you know, in a dungeon because, well, whatever. These were problems that a producer should have had. I mean, we had an extraordinary occurrence. A woman turned up claiming to be the executive co-producer. And everyone looked around because no one had actually heard of her. And somebody said, well, actually, she was Joe Proctor's ex-girlfriend. But I thought it was ex-girlfriend. And she announced, I think, that she was going to take over the art department. And the art department said, no, you're not. And then she was going to take over the costume department. And the costume department said, no, you're not. and finally, she settled into being just an executive producer, you know, given the per diem and the hotel and all that sort of thing. And Andre Zotz called me one night, and he said, "John, please, will you come round? I don't know what to do. I have no one to talk to. You know, I have no producer. I can't talk to this person and that person. And please come around." So I went round to his hotel room. Now, we're in a hotel in Hungary with no chairs. You can't sit on the bed, obviously. And so you've got two men on a very small sofa trying to maximize the distance between them, you know, having a conversation. And poor Andre was saying, you know, "What can I do? You know, he won't come because he can't work with her. And she's not fit to work anyway because of the obvious reason." And suddenly the phone goes. And so I make the, and he said, so I sit there trying not to listen to the conversation. And it goes like this: "Andre." "Yes, hello. We have a problem." "A problem? Which particular problem?" "Andre, I've just seen the dailies, and we have a problem." "Well, no. The lab report has come back good. You know, we've had no technical problems at all. You know, the film is looking good." "Andre, no one has talked to you about this clearly. And I guess since I am the executive producer, I have to speak to you directly. We have a problem, Andre." "Well, what is the problem?" "The film that you have shot, that I have just seen today, the dailies of, it's very repetitive." And there was that pause. He looked at me, I looked at him, we looked at the ceiling, we wrinkled our eyes and looked at the walls and tried to understand what "very repetitive" could mean. Trying to overlook the obvious thing that you've got a scene with a master and three or four takes, and then the same scene shot from a different angle, getting closer with three or four shakes. You know, trying to avoid the fact that this woman, clearly our executive producer would be, had never seen dailies before.
That's just so strange. The lack of, it sounds like Mel Brooks, the producers. That's what it sounds like. You know.
And the Hungarians, for the Hungarians, you see, this was so important. This was their first chance of doing an American film that might be popular and might open up the door of Hungary to the West and get more American influence in Hungary. And forget, we're still living under the Iron Curtain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still once a week slipping down with my $100 bill under one of the bridges of Budapest to give my $100 bill to buy an 8-ounce tin of beluga caviar.
The contraband, yeah.
You know, you make a conversation, you make a phone call from home. One night, to home, and one night I put the phone down and thought, "Oh, shit, I wanted to ask that." And I picked it up and I heard the last three words of my conversation played back to me.
Oh, interesting.
So you have that going on. You have these brilliant Hungarian filmmakers with their Freedom Hungary credentials being well hidden, but all working for it. And they're pinning their hopes on this American production. You've no idea. All those people that come to that concert, I mean, it was the biggest darn concert, rock and roll concert, that Hungary had seen in probably ever. That was how important, you know, culturally this event was for Hungary.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the standouts of this film. Not just the concert, because the size and the scope of it really brings things into perspective, where it's, you have a bear, and if this bear gets loose, everybody's going to be harmed. So they really raise the stakes with that. But the music, right. if this soundtrack is available, I am getting it. Because there's so much great music. In the choreography, I didn't realize that was Bruno Tognoli. So... Yes. There's a lot of hidden gems of this film, and there's a lot to like in such a short time.
Exactly. But of course, if you know, if your guy at the top is a con man, but it was. Filmmaking at that time was really like the Wild West, you know. There was the VHS had created such a demand for movies that the studios couldn't match them. So you had wonderful opportunities for filmmakers, you know, to make these relatively small budget films that would go on the big screen, you know, but then everyone, you know, there would be a huge income from, you know, from VHS sales and rentals and stuff like that. And it brought in a lot of pretty unscrupulous people. It brought in... I have to be so careful.
It's an adult show, so you can say whatever you please.
Oh, I mean, there were crooks financing films. There was I think I better be a little bit cautious there. Not because of the crooks, but there was a government involved that
I thought we were going to take you back to the Untouchables there.
But it was, you know, because there was so much filmmaking going on, there was a lot of the business of filmmaking became a cover for some other things as well.
Oh, yeah.
It was a fascinating time for filmmaking, and of course, as a young man, sort of caught up in this, and you know, hoping that this performance is going to be my, you know, it's going to be one of those things that people say, "Hey, Rhys Davies, you know, he's quite versatile. He, you know, he can do this as well." And I was looking forward to that coming out, and it was a matter of some disappointment to me that it didn't, but it could have had, I think it might have been one of those popular films that came out, and it would have done Hungary at that time, and that group of filmmakers, and poor André Zsolt, it would have done them an awful lot of good. But the American producer really didn't just fail us, and what other investors he did manage to steal from, but he also stole a lot of opportunity from Hungarians too, and that probably was had a harder effect on them. And I'm sure that an awful lot of small people never got paid.
Oh, wow. Do we know why it's been shelved so long?
Yes. Well, the story that I heard, and it might just be the thing, is because they couldn't get the animatronic bear to work, it sat on that lovely man Coppelson's, Ann Coppelson and who's the other guy? Very, very good producers. Sat on his shelf for a long time. But I think that that was basically a cover for the fact that there were concerns about what had happened to some money. There were concerns about, you know, where the money was, where the producer was with the money, where the rights were. I think that really you should talk to Suzanne Nagy about this, because she was the Hungarian producer who refused to give up on it, and you know,
oh wow,
and she has spent the time sort of tracking down things, making sure that the film, you know, that what footage there was kept safe, and she's the one who's actually brought it to the screen again. Her story alone is worth a story.
Oh, it sounds like the making of a good documentary.
a great documentary. a great documentary. But she's well worth the talking to. And how absurd that these two or three little kids, you know, all with very good theatrical genes in them, but you know, just beginning at the start of their career, you know, turn out to be, you know, Sheen and Laura Dern, you know, and George Clooney. I mean, I don't even remember meeting them. I think I met Sheen. I met Sheen very briefly, but I don't remember. And that in itself is an insight into my development as an actor, or actors' development as actors. When you start off, it's about you. You know, the concern is, you know, am I doing okay? Am I satisfying the director? You know, and this sort of thing. I don't want to let the other actors down. But you're not really interested in the other actors until you begin to sort of settle down and realize, actually, I do know how to do it. I can probably get by. I can probably hold my own. And perhaps it's only then. There may be less egotistical actors than me, but it took time for me to actually really start to notice what was going on around. Because I suppose I was fairly privileged in the sense that I went from being essentially a stage actor to having good support, to being a good supporting actor. I didn't have to grovel for the one line or two line and things like that. But I noticed as I became older, I first became sort of interested in what was going on and started watching younger actors and thinking, yeah, that's not too bad, actually. No, he hasn't got it. She hasn't got it. But he's got it. And slowly, the more you do it, the more interested you become in them. You know, and after a point, you're old enough to be trusted, so that when you see a younger actor struggling with a line or struggling with a director who really I can't again tell you the movie, But never before have I been, and it wasn't this one, obviously, but never before have I been, only once have I ever been on a film set where finally the DP exploded at the director.
Oh, really?
and said, shut the fuck up. You are confusing these actors. You are giving them the wrong direction. They can do this scene. Just sit down there. Let me shoot it. And he was absolutely right.
Wow.
You know, when you've got it, when you see actors with that mountain confusion on their faces, and the director, and you're listening to the director, and you're thinking, you are completely, and it isn't just a question of nuance or anything like that, you are completely sending this actor down the wrong road. You know, and you can just, and every take is, you can see worry on, not on his face, but other people's faces and things like that. There comes a point in an older actor's life where he can simply, you know, when the cut is right, let's go again. He can simply walk up to a young actor and say, now listen, your instincts are right. Do this. Now, hit that word there and lift the end of the sentence. All right? All right, let's go again. And suddenly, director says, and you know, the DP says, great take, moving on. And you can see most actors need help. All actors, well, like writers, all writers need an editor. And that's the hardest thing if you're a writer to learn, that our precious utterings actually need an editor. Remember that wonderful transcript of The Wasteland, Eliot's Wasteland, that he gave to Ezra Pound to edit. And Pound puts a red pen right through the first, 40-odd lines, and says, the poem begins here. April is the cruelest month. Even the greats need an editor. And actors need feedback, and actors need a director to sometimes say,
like a conductor.
Yeah, smaller. Do you know that marvelous actor, Brian Blessed?
I've heard of Brian Blessed, yes.
Now, Brian has so much bravura, sprezzatura, that in a way he intimidates directors. Brian is really a pussycat. A brave, intelligent, passionate actor. But just watching Herbie Wise directing him when he did I, Claudius, and he played Augustus. He would look at Herbie, and Herbie would go,
just bring it down a little bit.
Oh, just there. And he would bring it down, and you would just see what the man was thinking in his eyes. And it was one of the finest performances that Brian was ever allowed to give, because, of course, people want a Brian Blessed performance. But it done him no good at all. He's a far more subtle, measured, considered actor than producers, than directors are ever allowing to be most of the time. I love Brian. I think he's a great actor. Badly directed most of the time.
Can you tell when a movie is badly directed as an actor?
You can certainly tell when a director doesn't know how to direct. Doesn't know how to direct actors. By and large, it doesn't happen that often. There are so many good young directors around, you know, looking for work that, you know, that the key to directing, of course, is casting, isn't it? If you cast well, your cast will do the thing for you. What you're doing is directing traffic to a certain extent. But if you're really good, what you're doing is manipulating the overall shape of the movie, either through cuts. Who was that marvelous director who did Patton? Great director.
Look that up. I just remember George C. Scott.
Oh, yeah. But
let's see.
Oh, very famous director.
Wasn't DeMille, right? Let's see who it is. It was 1970.
Franklin Schaffner.
I think you beat me to it. Oh, yes, Schaffner.
Franklin was, I mean, he'd done B movies by the dozen, you know. He knew what he wanted to see. I worked with him on, I don't know, something. And I said to him, "You're a very economical director, aren't you, Franklin?" He said, "Yes, John." "Yes, I am." He said, "When you finally get round to directing yourself, and you probably will one day," he was wrong, sadly. He said, "Just remember this. Never give the editor too much leeway. It's your film. It's your vision. Give him what you want to see. And that will be a movie. You give him too much, you'll get anything but your movie, or your movie interspersed between other assorted things. A good editor doesn't just go with that perfect camera movement. A good editor goes with that absolute extraordinary moment that happens when the actor is thinking on camera. And, you know, some of the great, you learn so much from some of the great directors. And they are.
You've worked with some Jackson, Spielberg.
Jackson, Spielberg, yep. Frank Schaffner, my old friend J. Lee Thompson, who did The Guns of Navarone.
Oh, yeah. Lovely film.
Yep. He had three plays on in the West End by the time he was 19.
Oh, wow.
One of his films, Woman in a Dressing Gown, was instrumental in... It basically about the last woman to be hanged for murder in England. Was pretty largely responsible for the abolition of capital punishment. Lee was a funny man. Again, he had gone through a very bad patch. I mean, alcoholism was run of a mill for a lot of those 30s directors. And 40s directors and 50s directors. But, you know, the wisdom that they had, Andre could have been a considerable international director. This was his big chance. And as you can see, the visual of that, of the big concert, I haven't seen the film yet, and I haven't seen the cut, but I was there for the big concert, and I could see this is big film time.
Oh, yeah.
It's very odd how I suppose in every film there are acts of glory, acts of mercy, acts of betrayal. And it's very important that the producers don't betray, though probably they are more susceptible to betrayal. And it is very important that the actors, particularly the leading actors, set the tone of the film. If you were working with a Zeffirelli, Franco used to set the tone of the film. The film was basically about the genius vision of Franco, which was genius and had vision and was well worth just shutting up and going along with the ride.
No ad-libbing then.
John, darling, why are you not here at work? Well, Franco, I haven't been called today. Of course you're called today. You're working today. You're doing the scene, the big scene with your maestro. You're with him at that one. But Franco, I don't know which script you're working from, but that scene isn't in my script. Impossible. Darling, why hasn't John got the script for today? Franco, you know perfectly well you only wrote it for him last night. Oh, yes. John, darling, please now. I want you to give me something very beautiful, very special here now. Well, Franco, it's a page and I never mind about my words. You understand the intent of the scene. Come now, speak the intent of the scene to me. Bravissimo! I love you. Okay, now, what are we going to do next? My fucking hip is hurting me. Poor old Franco was, he hated his producer. This was young Toscanini. Poor Franco he needed hip surgery. He had his hip was rattling around in the socket and he needed a hip replacement. It was giving him great pain, which he was treating with a bottle of scotch a day and painkillers. So you may imagine that temperamentally, it was a little bit up and down. So when we actually got to, we were in Portugal, and the Portuguese television interviewer said, the president's brother alleges that you stole the idea from him. He let rip somewhat about the Portuguese character, the Portuguese president, the failures of the Portuguese people anyway, and the lying hypocrisy.
Oh, wow. That's a major faux pas.
Next day, we are out on the boat and the police come looking for him. So we are busily shuttling Franco Zeffirelli from hiding place to hiding place as they search the ship. The day after, we fly out. We smuggle him out of... he flies out. We get him across the border somehow, and he gets to Italy, and we fly to Bari to pick the film up there. I can't imagine that the producer was very pleased with that, but...
Wow.
Oh, you have no idea. The fun, the joy. Sometimes young actors can take it very seriously. Oh, my God. You know, there's, you know, we've got a real crisis on our hands. And do you think the film will ever be finished? And it is very important for the older actors to say, we will finish the film. Now calm down. There isn't a crisis, or there is always a crisis. Small and medium, but there is always a crisis. Now just calm. You're not concerned with that. You know, your job is to be prepared for the scene tomorrow. Now, would you do me a favor? Can we just run over it? Not for your sake, but just for mine, because, you know, I'm getting old and a bit, you know, I need to run the lights. But just calm. And if we don't do it tomorrow, we'll do it next time. There have been times in my life where...
Everyone thinks because you're a zombie, you don't know good coffee. Well, they're wrong. We have very active lifestyles. It's not all wandering the countryside aimlessly or scaring passing motorists. And we all love a good cup of joe. And there's only one brew that gets my seal of approval. Deadly Grounds coffee is my guilty pleasure. Bold, robust, delicious. It's coffee that can wake the dead. With over a dozen different roasts and flavors, Deadly Grounds can satisfy the most finicky of coffee addicts. The aroma is so intoxicating. It brings all of my neighbors out of the woodwork. Deadly Grounds coffee. Coffee to die for and zombie approved. It's good to get a little deadly.
Use the front door!
Oh, they're so disgusting.
Ooh, low battery. Oh dear.
You're okay, I can still hear you.
You can? All right.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to have to plug this in sometime soon. But, yeah, there have been times in my life when the director has had the nervous breakdown. I remember once in Moscow, she said to me, John, you're going to have to direct the film. I can't do it. I can't manage it anymore. And I said, I would love to direct the film. Love to. But then it wouldn't be your film, would it? It would be mine. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to take you out of that wretched Moss film, cockroach-filled room that you're in, and I'm going to put you in a decent hotel. You're going to spend 2 nights getting some sleep, and then we'll talk about it on Monday morning. On Monday morning, she was rested enough to be able to continue the film. Then there was the time in Kenya where he did have a nervous breakdown and he vanished and we had 3 days left and there was nobody there. And the director of photography and myself and one of the other actors, we said, right, we're going to finish the film no matter what. You take that group there and rehearse that scene. I will rehearse this scene. The DP will look at them, and when he's ready, we will shoot them. And we shot we finished the film that way.
Wow.
There are times like that. yeah, there was the time, too, when the lady producer came to my room and announced that she had developed an undying passion for me. And next week the paychecks bounced.
Oh, oh wow.
Yes. Well,
these are the things that you don't necessarily think about when you're sitting in the movie theater, eating your Twizzlers and your popcorn and just enjoying kind of this escape, you know, it's wow.
Yes. It's directors can be are very stressed because producers put a lot of stress on them. I did hear that the Directors Guild, the DGA, and this may be a few years ago now, but I don't know what it is, but the life expectancy of DGA members was 57 years.
Oh, wow. That's startling. That's worse than dentists. So,
yeah, it's really stressful because they're constantly being nagged. You know, we got to get this. Why haven't you got the scene? You know, I don't see why we've got a delay here. Why was there a delay? You know, if you don't get this done today, you're going to be replaced.
Oh.
And sometimes it's just unfair. Sometimes, you know, I remember working, I better be very careful, but we had a director who didn't know how to direct. We had a young and somewhat inexperienced crew. The director wasn't able to tell the crew what he wanted. And so he would repeat again and again and again and again. The crew, you know, were getting nervous. And when you get nervous, you make mistakes. And when you get criticized in public for making those mistakes, you know, you're concentrating more on avoiding the criticism, I mean, than doing the job.
Mm.
And I hate to see that bullying going on. In fact, you know, I'm now senior enough to be able to, you know, to gently say some gentle words. Because it is a collaboration. It's not my genius or your genius as the writer. It's his genius, that little kid called Clooney or something like that. That what's the girl called?
Laura Dern. And,
you know, it's actually involving them all, involving us all, and making something that sounds fresh and is interesting and tells a good story. And that's magic. And if you're privileged to be part of a world that tells stories. Yeah. Look, it's better than having to work for a living. you know, we say, oh my God, we had a hard day. Our days are hard. I mean, we always work a 5-day week. We generally work a 6-day week and sometimes it's a 5-day week. It's always a 12-hour day, but then you add a bit of travel in on that as well. Or, you know, if you're doing television, then, you know, you overshoot that day because they want to calculate it round so that you start at 6 o'clock on Monday morning, but by Saturday or Friday rather, you know, you're only starting at 6 o'clock at night. So you go into Saturday morning, you know, at about 8 o'clock Saturday morning, and then you've got your 12-hour turnaround or something like that. You don't really get the day off. You know, it's really hard. But that said, it isn't as hard as, you know, having to dig ditches for, yeah. or
luckily, the pay's better, so.
Yeah, there are times when you don't get paid, but I did get paid on this one.
That's good.
Not sure everyone did. I'm pretty sure that some of the Hungarians didn't get paid. You know, and when you're living in a society where income is low anyway, you know, it can be really damaging when you don't get paid. There was one of the two Columbus pictures that were done. It, they announced they were going to shoot. They went to this island, you know. They started putting in orders for stuff to be constructed and this sort of thing. Now, the local craftsmen, you know, were geared up to their level of production. Suddenly, they're seeing real money coming in. And so they're buying new tools and things like that. And there's the promise of more money. And then we want this extra set. Okay. So they're you know, buying on tick or on credit and this sort of thing. And the money hasn't come through this week, but it's okay. Listen, they've spent so much money here already. They're going to be good. You know, and finally, you know, the production left the island with unpaid bills. They ruined the livelihoods and the lives of so many small people.
Oh, wow. But
they don't matter, do they?
That's horrendous.
Horrendous is the right word. You know, and when you hear that, you really feel you want to be savage and bitch slap somebody.
Yeah, I think that's the right word.
But Grizzly is one of those things that, unfortunately, because some people are still alive, and I may have to wait for my memoirs to actually write the full comedy part that I remember about it. But it's that wonderful mixture of hope and cynicism, of real serious endeavor to create something wonderful and self-destructive vanity and corruption. You know, you galvanize an army to go and conquer, you know, and you abscond with the quartermaster's funds and leave the army marching and I remember a lovely chap, and he'd been part of a group called Status Quo. Do you remember that song, Whiter Shade of Pale?
I do. I thought that was Procol Harum.
Sorry, I beg your pardon. Procol Harum. It was Procol Harum. And I worked with him when...
I'm a big fan, so I know.
You know how it ended, do you?
Well, no, I'm just familiar with the song.
All right, okay. Now, listen, I've got 5%. We're going to be cut off shortly. When we are, adieu and thank you for your patience. But I'll just finish the story.
Certainly.
They got this gig. The things hadn't been too good with the gang anyway. But they got approached by this gypsy who was going to have this major gypsy wedding in Germany, in the Black Forest. It was going to be huge. And they were going to get a huge sum of money. They arrived, they set up, and slowly these people began. And it was a huge weapon. There were 1,000 or so gypsies, you know, all beautifully turned out, and they were ordered to play. And they played. They did 3 hours, and then they were then going to stop and take their break. No, 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 you keep playing. So they played. And they played again. And they played again. And by about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, people started drifting away. No, no, you keep playing. You keep playing. And finally, there was no one there. And the music came to a halt. And they looked at each other, and they knew they weren't going to get paid. And somehow it had come to the end.
Oh, my goodness. That's so lovely. I certainly feel like that sometimes.
Yeah. Du Bois, listen, thank you for your patience. Speak kindly of our film.
Oh, of course.
Now, look, I imagine you're in lockdown at the moment.
Yes.
If you're running out of things to write or do or say, or just want to pick a fight with somebody, you've got my contact number now.
Oh.
Send me an email. And if you want to you want to talk about something else one day, you have the number. The initiative lies with you.
I would love to talk to you about some James Joyce sometimes.
Ah, yes. Once upon a time, and a very good time it was too, there was a moorcow coming down the road. The cow passed the house where Betty Byrne lived. One day he was going to marry Betty. When you wet the bed, first it is warm and then it is cold.
I love it.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And you know those marvelous erotic letters between Joyce and Nora.
Turns out he and I share a birthday 100 years apart.
How perfect. You must look at those love letters between Joyce and Nora, because no matter how sexually mature, confident, experienced you are, I guarantee their boldness will shock you.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much.
Okay, take care, dear boy. Talk to you again.
All right. Goodbye, sir.
Bye-bye.
Wow, what an excellent interview.
What a great job, Justin with an I. You asked all the hard-hitting questions. It's like, we haven't even listened to it yet.
Ah, the suck cut. It definitely does suck.
Oh, man, I love it, dude. Yeah, but dude,
hope you guys enjoyed it.
Hey, but like, dude's a cool guy, and stop asking him. I haven't watched the movie yet. We haven't watched Grizzly yet. We might watch it.
Grizzly 2!
I get it, dude. That's what he was pushing.
We're two Grizzly dudes.
I know, which Grizzly Adams is my nickname.
Grizzly Adams did have a beard.
Did Grizzly Adams have a hairy dick?
I don't know. I don't want to check that. All right, guys. Well, thanks for tuning in. Hope you liked it. If you want us to have more interviews, let us know.
Yes.
And if you have anybody in particular you want us to interview, hit us up.
Yeah, and hit us up at Geek Life HQ on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and leave us a voicemail on Anchor FM.
Or head over to geeklifehq.com, and you can just find everything there.
Yeah.
It's simple enough. So, yeah, guys, check you on the next episode.
See you later. We got the beef.